By our guests' count, there are well over 500 food halls in operation or development around the country. In some ways, it's a sign of post-pandemic times and the evolution of dining out. Whether in urban CBDs or suburban locales, food halls are trending with unique challenges and opportunities at every site. On this episode, we learn what makes food halls work. We sit down at a space overlooking Times Square in New York City, above one of our guests' newest projects, just before its grand opening, a coffee house concept called Central Perk, inspired by the classic ensemble sitcom, Friends.
Here where we are sitting right now in Times Square, you'll see 1,000 brands outside the door, but you won't really see anything that is a one-off. Food halls very often were places where small business one-offs could come together in a much better environment than, let's say, a food truck scenario and create an ethos.
That's Phil Colicchio, principal at Colicchio Consulting, a specialty food, beverage, and entertainment advisory established in 2005. Phil cut his teeth in the restaurant business as an attorney. He represented 75 James Beard Award-winning chefs from all over the world, among them his cousin, celebrity chef Tom Colicchio.
We're still extremely bullish on the food hall space. We're consulting on 40-odd food hall projects around the country.
And that's Tripp Schneck, the managing partner of Colicchio Consulting, who came out of the hospitality industry where he was an operator and also managed a privately held hotel REIT with $2 billion of assets in the portfolio. We also have two leaders from CBRE's New York Tri-State Region Retail Services Group who've developed projects with recognizable brands like Hershey's and the NFL, as well as food hall spaces at places such as the iconic Grand Central Station.
New York has come back in a way that if you have a large space at the base of a building, you have options.
That's First Vice President Preston Cannon, who's been with CBRE for 18 years. Preston joined us alongside Matt Chmielecki, a CBRE Senior VP and 21-year veteran of the company.
When office brokers bring their tenants by, their first question is, who's your food?
Coming up, Table for Five, taped before a live audience of colleagues and clients, we answer that important question and more in conversations with these esteemed food hall insiders. I'm Spencer Levy, and that's right now on The Weekly Take. Welcome to The Weekly Take, and we are in the least busy place on the planet, Times Square, our second episode taping here to talk about food halls, an element of New York, an element of a lot of other places that is activating space. Starting with Phil Colicchio from Colicchio Consulting. Phil, thanks for coming out.
Oh, it's really nice to be here with you. Thanks for having us.
And we have Tripp Schneck from the same place. Tripp, thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
And then CBRE's own Preston Cannon. Preston, thanks for coming.
Thanks, Spencer. Appreciate it.
And Matt Chmielecki, also from CBRE. Thanks for coming out.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just start with the very big picture. And I think that food halls have both an independent identity. You can have a great facility that's just a food hall, or a identity that is connected to the real estate in it or around it within an office building is really where I'm going. So, Phil, just before we go into the nitty-gritty, just tell us, what is a food hall?
Well, it's probably easier to tell you what a food hall is not, right? Because food halls really, when they began to become an actual movement in the nation about 7 or 8 years ago, the key to it was these were artisanal places. These were places.
What does artisanal mean?
Artisanal means that it's not a chain restaurant.
Yeah.
It's not one of 100 stores. Here in where we are sitting right now in Times Square, you'll see 1,000 brands outside the door, but you won't really see anything that is a one-off. Food halls very often were places where small business one-offs could come together in a much better environment than, let's say, a food truck scenario and create an ethos, right? Create a point of view about presenting food in a fun way, in an artisanal way, in an experiential way at a reasonable price. In food halls that we advise on, you won't see many that have chain restaurants. Every once in a while, you'll find one, but usually if they're chain restaurants, they're from another country. You know, occasionally we'll have something in from Hong Kong, right? Or from Turkey or something like that. But artisanality, in my view, is chef-driven, right? And so that's where people really began to fall in love with the food hall world.
I'll tell you my definition.
And this is Tripp speaking, by the way.
Yeah, it's a food hall is a collection of chef-driven, fast casual, non-chain food and beverage options. So if you see a Shake Shack, a Sweetgreen, or a Sbarro, you're in a food court, right? So the biggest difference between a food court and a food hall, certainly the vendors being independent in nature, the heightened sense of community, and most importantly, the beverage. The beverage component, the bar component, are big parts of what make food halls successful.
So rather than debate whether a food hall is all artisanal or some artisanal, some national brands, what a food hall is to the people that are listening to this show is a successful real estate story that is either independently successful or enhances the success of the real estate around it.
Well put.
Yep.
And we are in New York City today, and the definition of a successful food hall here is very different than the definition of a successful food hall in, say, a more suburban market. What's your point of view, Phil?
Well, it's a little bit tougher now in the city, I'll tell you that, and it's not just New York City. And that's because, frankly, it is probably the single greatest hangover from COVID that we see. This New York City, no matter how busy it has become in the last maybe 2 or 3 years, still not what it was from a workday standpoint that it was pre-COVID. Meaning there are not automatic 5-day work weeks and there are not automatic bodies in the city, right? So if a food hall was built to satisfy a constituency in Midtown, a great and clear example are the urban space food halls, and that turns into 3 days or 4 days, you can't survive losing 20 to 25% of your business. So now food halls that are opening in New York are opening, as Tripp said, bar first. Right? Meaning we are going to create an environment that is going to extend the hours of this food hall into the evening. But we can't do that unless we have a good, strong bar program. And bar today does not mean alcohol only, right? A bar today means beverage program, right? And it means a truly broad beverage program. It can be zero proof. It can be coffee forward. I don't like the phrase mocktail, but it can be mixologist forward without alcohol. But it damn sure can also be alcohol, and that's still where the money is.
I know we're getting a little granular here on alcohol versus not, food hall versus food court, but let's stick with today. You're a landlord in New York City. I want my office buildings to succeed. Preston, the food hall was probably the first choice on your agenda in 2019. Is it today?
I don't know if it is. It really depends upon the area of the city that you are in, right? I when I think about food halls, trying to make this not the longest story in the world, but I think about Lehman Crash, a lot of food trucks. Food truck culture became really popular. Then coming out of that, you had the first urban space, 2010, I think it was, at Vanderbilt. And that was, they took an old TD Bank space, the base of...
How big is the space, by the way?
7,000-8,000 square feet.
Is that optimal? Would you say bigger? Because Grand Central's enormous, but it's a unique space.
From what we've seen, you can have smaller, you can have much larger. Yeah. At that time, that's what they took. They took a space that was on the market for a number of years. They had operated the Union Square Holiday Market and the Columbus Circle Holiday Market, and they did something really unique and special. But it was taking what you saw on the street under one roof. And that resonated really well with people. Over the years, there were more and more food halls, pretty much up until middle of COVID. I mean, 2020 to 2022, we saw 6 new food hall openings in New York City. It wasn't until 24 where they started to take a dip. And maybe it was oversaturation, maybe it was cannibalization of uses. But now New York has come back in a way that if you have a large space at the base of a building, you have options.
So I agree with Preston entirely. Are landlords thinking, you know, we need to put in a food hall? And not necessarily. But if your question, Spencer, was, are they thinking, do we need to have a quality food offering? 100%. Mm-hmm. So they're very focused on food as an amenity. There are buildings, very successful buildings, with big swaths of office upstairs, and you'll have a lot of retail at the base. And when office brokers bring their tenants by, their first question is, "Who's your food? What kind of food are you planning here?" It's important.
Yeah,
It's been that way since I can remember. That office developers with vision understood that having something notable on your ground floor and something that potentially was years ago, I think it was more to impress the decision makers as opposed to the employees, right, that were there.
Yeah.
Like, is the CEO of my tenant going to want to be seen at lunch here? That was important. That's changed, right? We want to have our tenants' employees here. The one we have to look at, I mean, in New York, absolutely 100%, and it's coming in 2026, is what is going to be in the building at 38th and 5th, the former Lord and Taylor building. I'm blanking.
Shaver Hall.
That's going to be operated by the group out of Dallas that we've known for years that has got the, what's the large one in Dallas?
Yeah, it's Food Hall Co., and they operate two of the largest food halls in the country. They operate Legacy Hall in Plano, and they operate Assembly Hall in Nashville.
And these are big food halls, bar programs.
Full service dining,
and lots of live entertainment.
Yeah.
Right? So the idea of what a food hall is evolving to, especially in the city here, right, is that's going to be the new leader. And I think that's the best part about New York, frankly, is that we in New York can take inspiration from the big things, right? Because there are so many big things, and kind of create little crafted versions of them, you know?
For sure. I mean,
to go back to your original question about office buildings and food halls, I mean, I agree. Food halls can be an answer. Same thing we see in the hotel world. Right, is how do you differentiate in a sea of sameness? And that could be in the form of a food hall. It could be in the form of a cafe or a rooftop or a restaurant. The challenge with New York City and office building food halls is the same thing we see in the Loop in Chicago, right? Is that they have the daytime population, they don't have the nighttime, right? And back when people were working 5 days a week, as Phil mentioned, you could have a very successful food hall, Revival Food Hall in Chicago, in the Loop, 12 vendors, each doing $1 million, all of their business from 10 a.m. till 3 p.m., and then they shut down on the weekends. Great business. COVID hit. People don't come back to work. Now you've got 3 days. So, you know, I think you can do it. I think it's a different design. I think it's different programming. But it's really the reason why we're seeing a lot more of the food hall development out in the suburbs.
Let's shift now to the suburban side of this, right? So we've talked about it being an amenity, now about a standalone. How does that work?
We're tracking this, and we study this. It is somewhat mind-blowing about the progress and the development of food halls in suburban and other secondary markets. It's counterintuitive, okay? The food hall, I'm sorry to tell you, is not about the food. There are four pieces to a food hall that make it hum. Number one, by far, is design. You got to design it right for ease of use and for flexibility, because you're going to need that bar program, you're going to need that other type of programming. Number two and three are almost the same, operations and programming. I've got to have a very good professional operations team that can operate that food hall and who can program that food hall. Food hall operators, up until maybe 5 years ago, would simply hire somebody to help them program. But now what they're doing is bringing that in-house, and it's very important. The fourth thing, surprise, surprise, is the food. And the reason that we say that really it is fourth out of four, we are blessed in the United States of America, in every market we've been in, Omaha, we've been to North Dakota, we've been to LA, we've been to Alabama, we've been to Georgia. We find great food. It's there. And we find great vendors, people who really love what they do. And so we're never too worried about populating as it relates to the food. right? We're worried about making sure that we can create a program, an overall program, beverage program, food program, entertainment program that works. And that's why out in the burbs where they haven't seen this stuff in quite a while, we're seeing it's not a renaissance, it's an absolute new wave.
We track all 470 food halls, right, in the United States. And we're tracking 114 food halls in development right now. You know, the average size of the ones in development are right around 13,000 square feet, you know, 10 to 12 vendors. There's definitely a movement in size coming down. 10 to 15,000 square feet is kind of the sweet spot.
You don't want them cavernous. You want them to be intimate.
Yeah.
And that's part of the whole look and feel, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
We've done destination food halls that can stand on them by themselves because they have the right density and the right demographics and the right parking. We've also seen them do very well as part of a mixed-use development, become foot traffic generators and create the halo effect that they're supposed to on the additional residential or retail or office. I think it's harder from a standalone to create the demand. But, you know, Roswell, Georgia is a prime example of a suburban market. Owners there bought an old church, converted it.
Just that's sad.
Yeah, Roswell, Georgia, food hall is called the Roswell Junction. It's about 12,000 square feet. Good suburban community, good demographics, and the community has embraced it. It's been open for a year. It's become the community hub where soccer teams go after a game and couples go for date night and families go for communal meals. And, you know, the best thing that food hall did, though, was they created an entertainment space. So on one side is the food hall and the bar, and on the other side is a performance venue that can seat 200 people.
Yeah.
Right?
So intimate spot.
What you have is you cover the day, you cover the different day parts that you'd think a food hall, morning, lunch, and dinner. And then what happens at 7 o'clock is that dinner crowd moves on and the 8 to midnight crowd shows up to see live music, comedy, TED Talks, the different ways that things program. So that's the key, right? I mean, the and it goes with the bar, the programming, the activation, giving people another reason to visit the food hall besides the food, right? That programming is so important to the success of these things.
Speaking of great concepts, great space, what a privilege it is to be where we're sitting right now today. And if people saw the actual place that we're taping today, you'd be here tomorrow. We are opening up Central Perk. And tell us about that.
It began as a COVID fever dream, to be honest with you. I received a call from a colleague of mine in Los Angeles pre-COVID. He and his family, as a family gathering tool, would sit and watch Friends. His kids were then young high school kids. He said, my kids are telling me that a Joey's sandwich shop or a Central Perk would be a killer. Right? And I said, well, I'm not so sure about that, but okay. And he said, would Cousin Tom be interested in participating in this? And on any other day, Tom Colicchio would have said no. But on that day, Tom was worried that 5 or 6 leases that he had signed that had witchcraft sandwich stores in them were crashing. And he said, well, if I could populate these... Well, and I said, okay, then let's talk about this. We got to move fast. This guy got a meeting, because he's an LA guy. He got a meeting with the Warner Brothers global licensing team. And we went in and talked to them. And long story short, they said, we've been pitched on Central Perk so many times by so many big companies that we didn't want to do it. We never thought we'd find the right people. Would you really do it the way you described it? And we said, well, that's the only way we know how to do it. We don't want to have a knockoff of the set. We want to have good food, good coffee drinks, potentially alcoholic beverage. We want to be inspired by it. Like, what are these people doing today? Warner Brothers liked it. COVID hit, so we had a slow start. We opened our first one a couple of years ago in Boston. It's been very successful. 205 Newberry Street, if anybody from Boston is listening. It has really captured the imagination of Friends fans and non-Friends fans alike. There are some people who are in the Friends universe who are very, very much in the weeds about the details of Friends. we have little things for them, little Easter eggs for them. But for most people, you're going to be able to get great coffee drinks, really good food, fair price, and an environment that makes you happy, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not meant to be a set of the show. It's supposed to be a modern interpretation of what a Central Perk would look like 30 years later. The Boston store is a little bit different. It's more of a neighborhood hang. 40% of our visitors are repeat. And so it's meant to serve for tourists and for locals. Times Square is a different thing, right? This is going to be a tourist. But it's got a warmth to it that I think regulars and office buildings and hotels workers around here will see.
We're super excited about this opportunity. Warner Brothers is very excited about the opportunity. They find Central Perk is a very, very important intellectual property to Warner Brothers. It is the number two valued intellectual property in their portfolio behind Harry Potter. And globally, the popularity of Friends is truly a remarkable set of numbers. Did you know that more people in the world have learned how to speak English by watching Friends?
I've heard that.
Right, than all of the studying that you could do.
That explains everything, because my daughter, 16-year-old Rose, you're getting a shout out here, binge-watched every single Friends episode over the last few months. And so now I know that she speaks the way she speaks.
Well, you know what? There's something positive about that, because the reason this show is popular, and by the way, people have written PhD dissertations on it, and I've read them. The show's popularity is because these people, at the end of the day, always supported each other,
mm-hmm.
right? Could have been corny. It could have been funny. Could have been sad. At the end of the day, they had a support group, right, that was literally always there for them. I think it tells you something. You know, people still binge it 30 years later.
We're 5 years past COVID. People are working 3.5 days a week, approximately, in the office. People's patterns of being in the city have changed. How has restaurants, food halls changed 2025 versus 2018 because of COVID? Less rents, more percentage rents. You don't have to get into the specifics of what people pay, but what is the big change in the restaurant food hall scene today versus 5 years ago, 6 years ago?
Well, I'll say flexibility became very obvious. This is a very macabre thing to say, and Preston's heard me say it a bunch of times, but yeah. You know how they say the best thing for a forest sometimes is a forest fire? That's kind of what happened in the F&B industry and food halls in the city. The ones that fizzled were probably on their way to fizzling, if not, you know, in the near future and you know, further on down the road. And the ones that survived thrived, and it opened up the door for more to come in. And now you have that flexibility to be able to piece in. If one piece of the puzzle isn't working, look at a food hall with one empty stall. Like that it glows almost. You know, what happened
there?
It's
a missing tooth.
It's a missing tooth and a smile. That's exactly right. So you want to be able to plug something in right away.
Mm-hmm. So are you seeing different structures and leases that allow you the greater flexibility within? Can you move the different tenants around within the food halls?
Supreme flexibility, but it only comes if you're handing, you can't tell somebody build it out entirely on your own dime and we can kick you out at any time. So you need to hand them all of the infrastructure, and you're plugging and playing until you don't work it.
I think COVID exposed the major flaw in restaurant leasing, right? High fixed rent, right? And, you know, Phil and I have done enough restaurant deals in our time that, you know, and I'm sure you guys have experienced it. They all say, well, we don't want to be in the F&B business, right? Well, that's fine. Every landlord during COVID was in the food and beverage business as they were restructuring rent deals. I think one of the reasons why food halls were so much more resilient than full service restaurants during COVID, not just because they quickly adapted to delivery models and they had those things in place, but was rent structures, right? So food halls are predominantly percentage rent deal structures. Developer comes in, builds out a food hall, engages a third-party operator through a management agreement. The manager or the venue operator engages third-party tenants through percentage rent licensing agreements. And there's a shared risk reward between all three groups. without that fixed rent component. So what we saw during COVID, you know, when we were seeing 40, 50% of restaurants go under, we saw a fraction of that in the food halls. And it's just it's because of the way that these things are typically structured.
And I think the important thing that came out of it that you kind of hit on there is the operator.
You're so right. And we have these conversations with our clients, again, the real estate side, ownership side. Tripp and I laugh about it because one out of every five says, what if we self-operate? And then, you know, that's sort of like asking us, you know, what if I give a loaded gun, you know, to a kangaroo, right? But I we say, well, what is your plan? And do you have anybody in your space who has operated multiple unit food and beverage properties within your company? And do you have a plunger? Because you are going to be the one who has to go in, you know, at 2 a.m. and plunge the toilet. You need to be prepared, right? And there are really good professional operations groups out there that can get you to bed every night. You know, no, yes, and you're paying for their service, but you are paying for that service so that all of the other components of your food hall can perform at a very high level.
A lot of behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Right. And by the way, on this show, we often get great expressions that we use again. Giving a loaded gun to a kangaroo may never be heard on this show ever again. But I do want to go to just one money question, and then we'll go the wrap-up question. So if you go to a high-end New York City restaurant, new opening, it could very well cost. People don't realize just how expensive it is to open a restaurant. It could be $10 million. I mean, it's real money. And it could, okay, $15 million, and it could take 2 years. How much does it cost to put a food hall in versus, let's say you have...
You've got the expert right
well,
here.
There you go.
The national average for fitting out, building out a food hall, including FF&E, is right around $400 a foot.
Okay.
So you can...
That's
you
the
can
national
do,
average.
You
New
can,
York?
You can do something really
New York
great.
Well, and New York not only higher, but you just sometimes can't. In New York, a lot of the times you either can or you can't. You know, you have all these stalls. They all need a hand washing sink, which means they all need floor drains, which means they all need gas. They all need hoods. They all, like, the amount of infrastructure. And some of these buildings are 100 years old. More
and
than
then,
that.
And then there's the moment in time in New York where you do all that studying and you're ready to break ground, and somebody said, is that a church there 99 feet away?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I can't get a liquor license?
Yep. Absolutely.
So that happens here more.
What does a liquor license cost in New York City?
It's not what it costs. It's,
right.
It's the headache on your way
community
through.
So community board approval. Right.
Community boards. It's by the way, I think New York does a great job with liquor license applications approval process. I think they do a great job. We see it all over the country. And even though, you know, for a giant city,
yeah,
it is one of the better functioning aspects of the hospitality side.
Yeah.
One more question. You mentioned the new food hall coming into the old Lord and Taylor space. Conversions is the big story for office buildings generally. Is this a real thing for food halls, or is it kind of just kind of hit or miss is the wrong word, but niche-y like the Lord and Taylor space?
I think we'll all make a big mistake if we think that the food hall that we knew a few years ago when Urban Space opened its doors in Vanderbilt Hall and the food hall that will exist in 5 years, if we think they're the same thing, right, we're mistaken. We've already seen this process. 5 years ago, we said we're in the second inning of food halls. I think we're in the third inning now because things changed so fast over the last several years. Lots of great things are gonna happen. The food hall universe is gonna change, it's gonna evolve, it's gonna get better. It can't help but get better.
Any final thoughts? We're going to go around the table. How about we go with Preston Cannon?
Yeah, that's all right. You know, I think we hit on a lot of topics today, but one of the things is the excitement to see what's coming, what's new, what's taking a fresh look at what we've come to know and love over the past 10 years. I think, you know, the interesting thing, when Matt and I always talk about it because we work right across the street from Vanderbilt Hall, is in Manhattan, where is it going price-wise? Because we're getting to a point where you might be better off going someplace else. It's becoming an expensive lunch, an expensive dinner, and the convenience sometimes isn't there. So that would be something I'd look forward to seeing how that evolves in the near future.
And expensive, look, I'm not here to say that restaurateurs should make as much money as they can, but people try to spend less than $25 for lunch. Some people try to spend less than $15 for lunch. I had two great dogs yesterday for Grace Papaya for $5, and it made me really happy. But the point is that price point matters, and it's probably the area that is the pushback on putting more food halls in.
Yeah, that's, I mean...
Okay, we got a disagreement.
No, I'm only because you asked me to be forward thinking, right? And so here's what I'm going to say, and it's not a political statement. New York City is not going to get less expensive over the next 5 years. Food hall and food hall food is going to be the most reasonable priced alternative that people have at lunchtime. Because, again, I love New York City. And I love the diversity of New York City. And now we've got a truly interesting situation with a new administration coming in who is very, very committed to a $30 an hour minimum wage. Restaurateurs do not make a lot of money. The margins in the restaurant business are thin, thin, thin. When labor ratchets up to that kind of amount of money, it's going to get passed on to the consumer. Period, paragraph, that's it. And so your hot dog at Gray's ain't gonna be what it was yesterday.
By the way, I've been going to Gray's since the 80s. You used to get a dog for $1. Okay, so I know what inflation looks like. But for $5, it was still a good deal.
But look, I still don't see it, and I know that you fellas don't see it. Yeah. New York City is still going to get restaurants and food and people spending money on it. It is just going to happen here. That changes the hurt that you're going to see about that is not going to be in New York City. It's going to be elsewhere.
Matt, final thoughts.
I think it's, you know, Preston and I don't take our lunch to work every day. We go downstairs and we find some place to eat and we bring it back to the office, just like the majority of the people out there working big office buildings in the city. The competition is out there to be. And by the way, I'm not like, which of these 130 lunch spots am I going to hit today? I go to one of three or four every day. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is to become one of those three or four. For people are adventurous when it comes to dinners. Oh, where do we go? Oh, we have so many choices. What do we do? When it comes to lunch, you don't want to think about it. You want to go to one of those spaces that you already know. The food hall allows you to walk in and you're like, great, I can walk 10 feet that way or 10 feet that way. And you can actually expand what you're going to be eating day to day.
Final thoughts, Trip.
We're still extremely bullish on the food hall space. We're consulting on 40-odd food hall projects around the country. Some are amenity plays, some are standalone, suburban, central business district. I will tell you that I think the next great frontier for food halls is in and around college campuses. We've done it at Auburn. We're opening one up at MIT. The group that's in school right now grew up with the Food Network. And they have appreciation for how their food is sourced. They have an appreciation for the chef community. And college campuses have been known for two things, right? Cheap beer and bad food. And the idea of bringing in food halls in communal style settings as a way to bridge the gap between the university and the local community through food and beverage, I think is great. And every student housing developer that I know is thinking about it right now. And I think we're going to see a lot of development in and around college towns.
And for a father of a son at Michigan, he's very fortunate to have Ann Arbor there. It's a good food town.
We are working on one in Ann Arbor.
There you go. But I also have a son at American. And if you want to shift your focus to American first, I will just say as a father and seeing what my son eats, and I love you, Blake, but good Lord, how many days a week can you eat? What you eat, we need a better food hall offering in American too.
Gotcha. We're on it.
Well, on behalf of the Weekly Take, what a great discussion today in front of a live audience, and we thank our live audience for being here today. We had Phil Colicchio. Phil is the co-founder of Colicchio Consulting. Phil, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Then we have Trip Schneck, partner, another co-founder of Colicchio Consulting. Great job, Trip.
Thank you.
We have our own CBRE's Preston Cannon. Preston, thanks for coming out today.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Spence.
And then we have Matt Chmielecki. Great job.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this look at food halls or would like to hear more perspectives on the role of food and experience in commercial real estate, I encourage you to check out our archive on the podcast platform where you listen to the show. You can also find more about assets in New York, including the last episode we recorded on location in Times Square, a conversation about Broadway theaters, and a deep dive into the story of this iconic destination, a show that's absolutely worth an encore. You can also find all that on our website, cbre.com/theweeklytake. And don't forget to subscribe so we can keep you posted on what's coming up. We look forward to seeing you again next week. I'm Spencer Levy. Be smart, be safe, be well.